Member Week is here at Lowe's. That means it's time for MyLowe's Rewards members to save big with up to 40% off hundreds of items like appliances, tools, home essentials, and more. Plus, get free standard shipping. Shop these exclusive member-only savings now through October 15th. Not a rewards member? Join for free today. Free standard shipping not available in Alaska and Hawaii. Exclusions and more terms apply. Loyalty program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.
Hey, Central Ohio. The nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
Wow. Look at that.
On the 19th of July, 1545, the pride of the Royal Navy was engaged in battle just a few miles off the coast here. It sunk in that battle with the majority of its crew, hundreds of men, still on board. In 1982, it resurfaced thanks to the help of divers and archaeologists, and it was brought here. I'm on a naval base in Portsmouth to explore the Mary Rose.
Hello, and welcome to a very special edition of the Time Team podcast. Martin is at Portsmouth's Historic Royal Dockyard, where the Mary Rose is being looked after by a team of experts. And I will be drilling down into the archaeology, learning more about the ship's significance and discovering the techniques that are used to do archaeology underwater. It's almost exactly 43 years to the day since the Mary Rose was raised from the seabed in October 1982. Now, those of us who saw it live on TV, which does include me, but not Martin, because he was not actually born then, we were just blown away by what was and is a huge undertaking, a remarkable feat of engineering. When you visit the museum, where the ship itself and the objects that were found within it are now on display, you can get a sense of its size and its grandeur, something Martin got to experience for himself at much closer quarters when he was taken behind the scenes, lucky Martin, by conservation manager David Pearson.
Well, so this is the airlock to go into the ship hall. So the ship hall inside, we've got conditioned air. So this airlock is to stop us ruining that conditioned air when we open the doors. We can head on in.
Okay, wow. Wow. Look at that. That is incredible. The scale is what really got me. 32 metres long with multiple decks, all clearly visible still. A crew of hundreds was needed to keep her seaworthy on long voyages. The timbers are big and heavy, and you can imagine how impressive the Mary Rose would have looked when she ruled the waves in the 1500s, the pride of the British Navy, now beautifully preserved for everyone to see.
We've got the remains of the hull of the Mary Rose. So this is what was raised in front of 60 million people live on television in 1982 and was then brought in here on this cradle. This is the original cradle on the barge, sailed into this dry dock where it's remained ever since. And it's gone through that conservation process, starting by being sprayed with water to remove salts and impurities. And then later on, the polyethylene glycol wax treatment that was sprayed over the ship for years and years. And that impregnated the wood, and it's consolidated the wood where it's degraded under the sea. We had voids within the wood, and now this wax had taken that place, and it's filled those voids, so that when we dried it, it's now this sort of strong structure that you see in front of you.
So why did the Mary Rose have to be raised in order for this conservation process to happen?
So for the polyethylene glycol treatment, it's a wax that dissolves in water, so we needed to raise the ship so that we could then do that sort of spraying technique to be able to get that wax to impregnate within the wood. There are methods where people are trying to preserve wrecks underwater, but for the way we were treating it, then this was the only way. And it means that the archaeologists can see different aspects of the ship, different cabins, they can look at the timbers, they can look at the dendrochronology, they can look at the starboard side, which underwater was really visible because it was underneath the ship. So it gives us an aspect of all of the ship itself to study and to be able to find all the artifacts as well.
So how is this ship maintained in this condition?
So this is a pretty much a large display case, really, a huge display case with the ship as the centre item. And we got control temperature and relative humidity in here. So the temperature is 20 degrees centigrade and the relative humidity is between 50 and 58%. And so that's sort of mid-range, really, which is ideal for wooden and organic items. You can't stop degradation, you only slow it down. So at some stage, everything will completely degrade. But how long that takes, we're not completely sure. Polyethylene glycol treatments were sort of started really in the sort of mid-20th century. So we're sort of still new, really, in the age of the treatment. So we're still looking at the long-term aging impact of that treatment. But it is reversible as well. So in the future, if another treatment came around that was better, we'd be able to take the polyethylene glycol treatment out of the wood and then treat it again.
Right, David, I'm going to leave you here now because I'm going to get a slightly closer look at the Mary Rose.
Thank you.
Gosh, you could see that Martin was really blown away by that. I mean, the first time you see it, the scale of the Mary Rose is so totally overwhelming because it's only a little bit longer than the Sutton Hoo ship, but it's so tall with those three main decks, it towers above you. And it makes me feel really old too, because I first visited when I was a teenager, when she was still being sprayed with water to rinse out the salt. And the idea that it was even possible to conserve it with polyethylene glycol, that was quite utopian. I think lots of people said it'll be impossible. It couldn't be done. We couldn't do this unless you could fit the wood concerned into a tank. And obviously the Mary Rose could never have been fitted into a tank. And then the drying out, that took absolute years as well. And at that point, the display was quite challenging because there could only be small windows because of the need to control the environment while they were extracting over 100 tonnes of water. And I remember very distinctly looking through the little windows and saying to my children, soon we will be able to see the whole thing, but at the moment we can only look through these little windows. It's so memorable. And the Mary Rose team were absolute trailblazers in doing this kind of thing. Now, let's head back to Martin, who's looking at the ship itself. He's about to get an even more detailed look at her with the help of Alex Hildred, who I'll be chatting to shortly. She's head of research at the Mary Rose Trust, and she's got a very personal connection to the ship.
Alex, a pleasure to meet you and to meet somebody who has so much knowledge of this ship as an archaeologist, but also you were one of the first people to go down under the water and actually help to bring this ship up. What does it feel like standing here right next to it now in this scenario?
Well, I can see it for a start, as opposed to only seeing a small bit. I think it's marvellous because it's now bringing, you know, the information that we've gained from it, the ship itself, and everybody can enjoy it rather than just the few, the sort of the 500 divers that worked between when it was first seen in 71 and 82 when it was lifted.
Well, I know you're keen for me to see it even closer than I am now, and you've arranged a little surprise.
An aerial ride, and you'll be able to see far more than we would ever see underwater, so be my guest.
Thank you, let's give it a go.
Yeah, this was pretty scary, but I couldn't pass up the opportunity to see the Mary Rose at close quarters.
Up we go.
Alex is taking me up in a cherry picker used to carry out inspections of the ship as part of the restoration process. It's allowing us to put ourselves at deck height, making it even easier to imagine what it might have felt like on board.
She was 12 metres deep, so the sad thing is that she's 12 metres wide. She literally sank, turned over. What that meant for us, it was a 12 metre swim down a line to get to the seabed, and very rarely could you see up to a meter would be very good visibility. So a lot of it was feel, and a lot of it was dark, but it was also, I wouldn't say it's claustrophobic, it was very comforting. It was like you were in being cradled by the ship. When you're working in a small area and it's just you and the sound of the airlift, there's nothing that intense as that sort of concentration, because it's just you and what you're doing in that 96 minutes, depending on where we were in the ship, different dive times. Now everybody can share it. Here there's a big bronze gong going this way. The deck above here, this is a plank from another deck, you can just see the beginning of it, but along here, facing forwards, was another big bronze gong which would have come to here. You can see the hole there, and all along that rail there are holes for swivel guns that have been blocked up in those cases, so there are no swivel guns anymore, but there are bigger ports for larger guns at the end. And then there's a big port here which had a large bronze gun in it. You can see that the ship has been transformed.
Now, I think it's time for Martin to come down from there before he remembers he has a fear of heights. I am so jealous of the amazing close-up look that Martin has managed to have, but I am delighted to say that Alex is with me now. Alex, thank you so much for being with us. Can I just start by asking you, I know the visibility was very limited, but when you were actually working on the wreck itself underwater, what were the other conditions like? I mean, I can't even imagine what the... presumably there's no soil under the sea. Were you digging through silt?
We were digging through silt, which was a bit like nearly soft butter that you can cut and it keeps a face rather than runs away. And then, but interwoven with that, we had things like seaweed lenses and gravel ballast, where in the early 19th century, a whole load of shellfish came in from the States and sort of died and made lenses. So there was stratigraphy, just like a land site. And we had everything from Coke cans at the top to obviously, you know, an oak leaf that we found beside the mast step that would have been there in 1545, you know, when the ship sailed. So a full length of, you know, 4 meters of stratigraphy within the hull.
Wow. And how do you actually do the work? I mean, I've read about where the trenches were, but how is a trench made? You know, how do you do your actual excavation?
Well, first of all, you have to realize that the Mary Rose is like a 5-story building, but it's been tilted on its side and then the top half is gone. So you're swimming in between decks, between the stories, if you like. And so the first sort of 8 years was spent trying to work out exactly what part of the wreck was there. And then in 1979, the decision, after having put a trench across the stern and realized that was a stern and one across the bow, that it would all be joined up. So we tried to do it like you would an open area excavation on land. But the immediate difficulties are you've got tides in the Solent that can get very strong, up to 4 meters over high water. You can only work on one side of the site when the tide's taking the silt away, because you don't want to backfill your trenches. So you've immediately got that basically two sites that are being worked at different times of the day on different tides, and the tides change every day. You've also got the fact that you're underwater, so you can only spend so much time. And we were very lucky that the seabed was 12 meters. It was obviously deeper once we got into the hull, but you had to cope with that. So your dive safety was absolutely paramount. We made airlifts, which are basically gutter pipes from downpipes of houses that the water goes down. So they're 100 millimeter diameter, which bring compressed air. You have a big tube that brings compressed air from the surface. So you turn it on and it gives you a vacuum, and immediately you get sucked up. So you've got to be really careful the way you open it. And learning how to use an airlift is unbelievable, because already you're in the water, you've got your legs maybe around the grid in order to be able to stay still. And then you've got this machine that you're trying to work and then feed the debris like you trowel into a bucket. We were using the airlift as a bucket.
Yes.
It was only used as a digging tool for going under the ship or outside when you were digging extra trenches. But inside the ship, it was literally to take the stuff away. And you can power it down really, really slowly and use it even just to alter your buoyancy to go up and down. Because obviously, as we excavated down, the grid stayed in one position. And we were then going down and down deeper into basically a very, very dark hole. Each area was a dark hole. And so you would then have to be in control of your own buoyancy rather than curl yourself onto the grid. And we tried different things like hanging trapezes from the grid. It was really quite exciting stuff. Mary Rose was very much of its time. Now nobody would want to raise it, leave it in situ, don't even, you know, excavate it. And B, just for the dive safety thing, it would be completely different.
Can I just ask you a bit more about the question of raising the Mary Rose? I remember it being raised. I was 15. I was glued to the television, and it was a really nail-biting event. And I remember feeling that this was an incredibly risky thing to do. I'm really interested to hear that you think that if we were doing this today, we maybe wouldn't raise it because ideas have changed. But was there much debate at the time about whether it should be raised?
No, I think that decision was made actually quite early on when we realized when the people who were making the decisions realized what they'd got. It was either stop immediately or go for it. Once it was decided to go ahead, it was almost a we've got to do it. However, we always kept money in the budget for backfilling should be necessary, because we bought the diving support vessel outright. We would be able to sell that and pay to backfill the site. So there was always that as a backdrop. But we you know, we all knew that the moment the decision would be made, it would happen.
Could we move on to the science on the Mary Rose? Now, we've heard a lot about dendrochronology on the podcast, and we've been amazed at what you can learn from it. Has dendrochronology been used on the Mary Rose? And if so, what kind of results have you got?
Well, yes, we've used it on the hull of the ship. As you know, the Mary Rose was built in 1510 and she sank in 1545. And there is some reference to her having had refits, etc. So we were trying to look at how the structure might have changed in that important period of time. And so they did show us when what timbers were original from the original one and some of the ones that were refit, but by no means all of them, because, you know, there are hundreds of timbers within the ship and we only managed to have the proper sections of those 104.
And how about the human remains? Because there were a lot of crew members on board, weren't there? And so you must have also a lot of human remains that can be analysed, but also that you have the it's a big thing to deal with, isn't it?
Well, we've got over 9,000 human bones. The crew listed is 500, only two names of people, and both of them were older than the complete skeletons that we've managed to reconstruct. We've partially reconstructed 98 of the 500, and the rest are just conglomerations of bones that were found, quite frankly, near routes of the people were trying to get out of the ship, or areas where water would have been pushing people down, etc. So they're all by companionways, ladders going between decks and various other things. So they're large areas of commingled human remains. Even within one skeleton, you've got bones that give you different signatures, etc. So we've been trying a number of non-destructive methods of analyzing them, but unfortunately DNA is sort of the best one, and we've tried that with commingled bones. We're getting some results, and of those, none of them were fairly complete skeletons, or maybe one of them. Most of those seem to be English, which is different from the one that we've had done with genomic DNA, which says that the father, if you like, of the individual that we've got was probably born in North Africa. And then some of the other ones that we've looked at for isotope analysis, which suggests that the climate people were in was warmer, for example, than England is or would have been then. And so we're suggesting that those come from warmer climates. And that was 4 out of 8 individuals that we had isotope analysis done a couple of years ago. So we're getting bits of information, but, you know, we don't want to be destructive.
No, it's difficult, isn't it? And you're getting these tiny little snapshots that isotopes we often think of as being able to tell us where somebody grew up. But you've just got this hint that it's warm. And so that doesn't work for England because you're in the little ice age in 1545,
yeah,
aren't you?
Really,
so they must be coming from far and wide. But then maybe you would think that sailors would come from far and wide. I don't know.
Well, yes, because they were. I mean, the mariners were certainly mobile populations. Certainly within England, they moved around and rarely stayed in the same place. The objects they were found might help. So one that came up as being definitely more warmer climate, which could be anywhere along the Spanish, Italian, that sort of area. The objects found with him, one of them was definitely an Italian tiny bit of casket panel that's dated from a particular workshop in northern Italy, the Embriachi workshop in 1525. So it was a keepsake, a small token with two angels carrying a flaming torch. You know, we've got those hints that go tantalizingly with the isotopes that suggest it might have been warmer, and obviously how far away from the coast and what sort of food they were eating during their formative years and the water that they were drinking. But it's by no means as accurate as genomic DNA, but again, both are destructive.
So. Yeah. Talking of finds, I know you showed Martin some of the thousands of objects that were recovered from the seabed. What would you say are some of the most interesting ones for you?
The most interesting assemblage as a whole has got to be the archery one, because it's like the only one we've got from a period where, you know, it's the last 50, 60 years of the longbow, and we have chests of them. I mean, the Mary Rose is listed with 250 bows in 5 chests, and we've got evidence of 4 chests and 179 bows or something, 173 fairly complete ones, and loads of arrows, you know, 7,000 arrows, out of which 2,000 are complete. So it's a really good, tight assemblage.
Wow.
And so that by itself gives us so much. You know, there are plenty of other things that you could say are as important. The assemblage shoes. You know, you've got very little in the way of the shoes that everyday people in Tudor times would have worn, because you've got things in paintings, and usually the paintings are courtly personnel, if you like, in the best clothes, whereas we've got humble shoes and a whole mixture of wonderful puss in boots, thigh boots with turned tops and things, to things that look like skull slippers. You know, we've got a fair number of those sort of things, which are good. And it's the everyday wear jerkins and things that people wear. And we've got a pocket, which is one of the earliest pockets. It's an inside pocket, but again, it's one of the earliest pockets on a leather jerkin. So, and it's perfectly dated, of course. You know, that's the, it was there in 1545. You can't...
can't argue with that. No, well, it's such an amazing snapshot of life in 1545, isn't it? It just has everything. And thank you so much, Alex, for coming to talk to us. It's been absolutely fascinating.
Hey Central Ohio, the nationwide Children's Marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide Children's Marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
Oh, the car from Carvana's here. Well, will you look at that? It's exactly what I ordered, like, precisely. It would be crazy if there were any catches. But there aren't, right?
Right, because that's how car buying should be. With Carvana, you get the car you want. Choose delivery or pickup, and a week to love it or return it.
Buy your car today with
Carvana.
Delivery or pickup fees may apply. Limitations and exclusions may apply. See our 7-day return policy at Carvana.com.
Well, speaking of finds, back at Portsmouth Historic Dockyard, Martin's been getting to see something that not many people see. There are so many objects that have been recovered from the wreck that they can't all be put on display to the public. So Martin's caught up with conservation manager David Pearson again at a nearby warehouse where some of those objects are stored.
Hello.
Hi, David.
Nice to meet you.
This is your little empire then, is it here?
Yes, this is our conservation facility.
Great. You've got some stuff to look at.
Yeah, come follow me.
It's not quite as beautiful as the museum, is it?
No, it's not quite as beautiful, but it's the things inside that are beautiful. And here's one of those. It's one of our anchors, one of four anchors we've raised from the wreck site. And it was raised in 2005, our most recent excavations. And it's actually one of the only whole anchor we've got. So both the flukes are intact and the ring as well. And you can even see some of the anchor cable down here still attached.
And this presumably isn't water here.
No,
it isn't. What's in it?
So to preserve iron especially, we've got to remove the chloride, the salt that's within the iron. Otherwise, if you raise it from the sea, then dry it, it'll start falling apart, start corroding. So we use alkaline solutions to remove that salt. And this is what this is. It's a pH 10 alkaline solution. And at this pH, the iron won't corrode either. So we could store this in this tank forevermore and it wouldn't fall apart. It would stay passivated, is the term.
This warehouse is a proper treasure trove. Rooms and rooms dedicated to items found with the Mary Rose, which very few members of the public have had the chance to see, including objects that give clues to the ship's violent naval past.
So if you're going to follow this way, we've got one of our artifact stores where we store the inorganic objects. And here we are.
Oh, wow. This is incredible. Cannonballs!
Yes, we've got some of the stone shot, which were fired out of the iron guns, and then we've got some of the iron shot that were fired out of the bronze cannons.
And how many are in here?
In here, we've probably got about 300 or 400 in total, but with the stone shot, we've got about 200 in the collection, some of which are worked into the shape that they'd have been fired, and then others are just rough cut bits of stone, because each gun had a different size bore on board, so they didn't know how many shot they'd need for each gun. So they'd take them on rough cut and then chisel them to shape using wooden shot gauges, which is quite a lot of work, especially if you then miss with your shot.
You know, there are so many amazing objects in this warehouse. In fact, I've recorded a more detailed tour with David for Time Team members over on Patreon. All the finds from the Mary Rose, of course, need looking after with expert care. And David's taken me to meet some people who are learning the ropes.
So here we've got a couple of our interns who are cleaning some of our anchor cable for us. We've got about 180 metres of anchor cable in the collection. We clean it to go into our store.
Hello, everybody. Hello. Hi, this looks like amazing work. What are you doing here?
So we're currently conserving this piece of rope from the Mary Rose. So we're using a toothpick, we're using scalpels and a toothbrush to remove the silt from in between the bits of the rope that you can see here, but not the pitch, because that would have been as it was with the rope originally.
Is it slightly sort of monotonous work?
Wow.
Doing this. It's a slow process, isn't it?
Just a little bit, yeah. After however many metres, it does become quite repetitive. And it's very in detail, so you have to look. Yeah, your eyes get a bit sore, but...
But you are working on a real working piece of the Mary Rose. What does that feel like?
Yeah. Oh, it's so exciting. I feel very honoured, actually, to be able to touch and, you know, handle this piece of history that's over 500 years old. It's absolutely fantastic.
Well,
it's wonderful.
I'll let you get on with it. Thank,
thank you very much.
It's so rare to get a time capsule like the Mary Rose. Normally, of course, archaeology is all about what's left behind when the people have left. So in the words of a famous book by Mick Aston and Tony Robinson, archaeology is rubbish. So all we know is that an object had been lost or chucked out. We don't know when it was actually in use or necessarily what it was used for. But in places like Pompeii or the Mary Rose, we get a snapshot of what was in use where at an exactly and precisely known moment. So it is really valuable. And I did a little count the other day and discovered that there are over 30 object types on the Portable Antiquities database, the database that I work for, that are dated thanks to evidence from the Mary Rose. And they range from things that you wouldn't expect to find on a shipwreck, like thimbles, to personal items like finger rings and buckles and purses, to things that you really always associate with sailors, like whistles. So they include very common and very rare objects. And from all this, you can tell that keeping the Mary Rose and all the objects associated with it in a stable condition is a huge task. Not only does it involve an enormous team of experts, it doesn't come cheap. The Mary Rose Trust receives no government funding. It means that securing enough money to keep the project running is hugely important, something that's becoming ever more difficult with rising costs. Now, to talk a bit more about that, we are delighted to welcome Dominic Jones, the CEO of the Mary Rose Trust. Hello, Dominic.
Hi, how are you doing? Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for being with us. It's really great to be able to talk to you because, you know, I've been to see the Mary Rose quite a few times. I tend to go about once a decade and there's always something totally new to see. But it always strikes me that it must cost the most fantastic amount of money to keep it preserved, to keep it from falling to bits, but also to be able to preserve it for people to see. How much does it cost per year?
It's in the millions. So we're sort of our expenditure is about 3.3 million pounds a year. And that is to keep the Mary Rose in the condition, to look after the artefacts. There's 19,700 artefacts. It's not just the ship that you see in the museum. About a third are on display. And to keep the whole trust floating. We're also responsible for the wreck site. So there's a lot that what we've got to do. And as you said, no public funding. And so 84% of our money, our income, comes from ticket sales, which is why we have to charge for the Mary Rose Museum. The Mary Rose is such a unique story. You know, it's the start of the Navy Royale. It's before the Royal Navy. King Henry VIII bought the ship when he came onto the throne, and with that and the Peter Pomegranate, and it lasted 5.5 of his wives. And it's an incredible, it's the start of empire and start of Britain and start of what we know today. And we need to tell that story more. We believe we're the custodians of authenticity. So that's why when you come to the Mary Rose, everything you see is real. There are fantastic museums. You know, if you go to SS Great Britain, I love it, but the cow's made of polystyrene. You go on some other warships, they're fantastic, but the cannons are fiberglass. Everything you see at the Mary Rose is real and it's authentic. So when we look at our future, it's like, how can we make it more authentic? So we've got the ship's ladders and we've got some of the ship's dividers that are currently in conservation. So let's get them back on the ship where they were because they're authentic and they're real and they're 500 years old. Those ladders were on the ship when the Great Wall of China was being finished and the Sistine Chapel was being painted, because that's the period we're talking about. This is an important part of history. But then there's the bit about the the other side of the ship, the starboard side or the French side, depending on which camp you're in.
Ah.
And that is not seen by the public. And it's such an incredible sight. You can see the waterline. You can see, it brings the Mary Rose and it brings the uniqueness of this ship that has survived against all the odds, against, you know, with the human endeavour that led to it to be not only found against the odds, but then excavated and raised against the odds and then shared to the world here in Portsmouth.
And so, preserved against the odds. I mean, I think when it was first raised, I remember thinking, well, that's just not going to be possible. You know, surely you can't preserve a whole ship like that.
What's great about the Mary Rose Trust and the Mary Rose was it rewrote maritime archaeology. Not only do we have the biggest everyday collection of Tudor life in the world, there is nowhere you can get closer to King Henry VIII's Tudor England than the Mary Rose. But also, in our modern history, we were the biggest ever maritime salvation operation to date.
Yes.
I mean, how amazing is that? So the humans, the 500 divers that were involved, the fact that everyone said it wouldn't happen, the fact that there was a storm the night before the Mary Rose was being raised, and that the Alexander McKee's divers were saying we can't do it, Margaret Rule's divers were saying we can't do it, the Royal Engineers were saying we can't do it. In comes the future king, Prince Charles, and he says, well, what would you do if you're at war? And they say, we'd do it. So he says, just do it. This is, I think, we should tell that story. We should tell the story about against the odds and the raising and the importance of the ship.
Now is the perfect time to visit, isn't it? Because your tickets last for 12 months. So if you come and visit now, you'll be able to visit all over the next year, including the summer holidays. And it is such an amazing place that you want to visit more than once, don't you? Even if you're from quite a long way away.
Yeah, you do. And actually, all of our tickets for the whole historic dockyard, so not just the Mary Rose, you get to see everything else as well. People coming and visiting, people getting involved, people looking at our website or listening to great podcasts like this or watching TV programmes about us, because it keeps the Mary Rose story alive. It's such an incredible British story that doesn't involve, you know, anything we have to give back to another country. It's a real fantastic story about a period in Britain's history that actually is incredible. And we've got this Tudor time capsule that we bring to life in Portsmouth in an authentic way. And the best thing you could do is come and visit and tell your friends to come and visit, because we don't get government funding. We don't get any funding from many other places. It's all about ticket sales. And that's how we can do all these future stories and future research and tell more stories and inspire more people. So the next generation could, who knows, go back down to the wreck site and bring the bow castle back up, which we believe might be down on the wreck site. So who knows what the future holds? We want to get people inspired and engaged so they can continue the Mary Rose stories for the next 500 years. I'm not a historian or a scientist. I'm a businessman or a theme park operator that now runs a museum. But I love it. I love it.
Well, I was going to ask you, what does being CEO of the Mary Rose mean to you? But I think we've all seen that you're incredibly passionate about it and also incredibly knowledgeable. You know, sometimes a CEO is very much the money, the business side of it, but you're clearly completely embedded in it. It's just wonderful to see. So thank you very much, Dominic, for coming and talking to us. Back for the final time now to Martin at the Mary Rose Museum in Portsmouth. And after a quick trip to the museum's 4D film experience, where you can dive with Alex yourself to the sea floor to encounter the ship and help lift it to the surface, Martin and Alex ended an exciting day on the uppermost viewing gallery, overlooking the Mary Rose as it's lit up with projections and sound effects, recreating life on board.
Oh wow, this looks so great just like this. You get a real feeling of what it must have looked like when it was
sailing,
down there.
Yes.
Yeah, and sailing. You got to dive this ship. You got to explore it when it was under the sea. What was that like?
Well, to begin with, it was frightening because we were diving by ourselves. We were using compressed air tools. It was challenging. But it was completely all-encompassing because it's just you and the job in hand. And I don't think you can ever be as driven as that again and ever be as concentrated on one thing. And the 96 minutes or 54 minutes, depending on which tide you were working on, just went like that. And you had to remind yourself to look at your contents gauge to see whether you were running short on air.
How will you most remember your time with the Mary Rose?
I think the camaraderie, the sense of we've got this thing to do, and that's all-encompassing, that's what your life was. For 3 years, I don't remember what songs were on. You know, it's like a complete blank, except for the Mary Rose. And to a certain extent, those people who've stayed associated with it are still carry that passion every day.
Wow. Now, this has been a really special edition of the Time Team podcast all about the Mary Rose. And huge thanks to Alex, David and Dominic at the museum in Portsmouth Historic Dockyard for hosting us. There's more from there for Time Team members on our Patreon. Head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial for an in-depth tour of the Finds Warehouse. Thank you so much for watching, and we'll speak to you on the next Time Team podcast.
Hi there, it's me, Tony Robinson. I'm back with a brand new series of Cunning Cast, my cunningly curated podcast where I dig into the histories of the stuff which fascinates me most. In Cunning Cast Series 3, I'm exploring fascinating new topics, including uncovering the mysteries of Sutton Hoo, in search of shipwrecks and sunken cities, new discoveries at Stonehenge.
There's this basic drive to build something that incorporates very different parts of Britain into a single monument.
Who is Vladimir Putin and what makes him tick?
There are some people who are genuine Putin friends. These aren't government officials. After, what's the point? If you are close to the boss, why not just become obscenely rich?
Who wrote the Bible?
It's basically really taking the pit out of the Roman Empire. It can't do it explicitly, but it's really saying these Romans are a nasty piece of work.
Why were the Beatles such great songwriters?
He's got this intuitive genius, and very little of it is kind of like consciously articulated or explainable even to himself.
No subject is off limits because everything has a history. So join me, Tony Robinson, for the return of my podcast, Tony Robinson's Cunning Cast. Now available wherever you get your podcasts. Go on, give it a try. You might like it.
Hey, Central Ohio, the nationwide children's marathon will be taking over the city on October 18th and 19th. COTA riders can expect significant reroutes throughout the city. Operators will be working tirelessly to assist COTA customers. That's October 18th and 19th for the nationwide children's marathon. Expect significant reroutes downtown. You can view real-time updates on the transit app or at COTA.com. That's COTA.com. Good luck to all the runners.
This fall in love with Cozy. Nothing says autumn like wrapping up in the rich, warm colors of Minky Couture. From golden ambers to deep burgundy and rustic browns, Minky blankets bring the beauty of the season right into your home. Perfect for crisp evenings, family time, or gifting someone special. Fall in love with Minky and shop your favorite fall colors today at minkycouture.com.